Well, it's the Greg Kelly podcast once again, and thank you for checking this out. Today, I am talking with America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. Yes, Rudy Giuliani. I can't believe that some people have the nerve to forget about his incredibly successful two terms as mayor of New York City. And of course, he helped lead this city and the country through September 11th, 2001. You know him more recently as President Trump's confidant and lawyer. And there's been a hell of a lot of controversy and, you know, I think harassment of him. I think he has been abused by the left, by the media, and they're fighting him because he is correct. He is right. And ultimately, he'll be vindicated by history. Actually, if you look at the facts, he doesn't need vindication. He's right. But so many people have smeared him, and it's unfair, and he's being hounded left and right. But you know what? I see him just about every day at WABC Radio. He is happy. He is always upbeat. He's everywhere, very accessible. You know, people who have something to hide, people like Joe Biden, you know, like they don't just sit down with reporters too often. They don't just make themselves available for every single podcast in the world. I mean, Donald Trump was available to everybody and anybody almost when he was president, and even since. Joe Biden, not so much. Rudy Giuliani is one of those guys. He's not afraid of the press. He knows his stuff. And anyway, we have a conversation about his life and how he got to where he is, but first, we talk about Ukraine. He spent a lot of time in Ukraine. He knows the players. He's actually met Vladimir Putin a couple of times. We'll talk about that. And did I mention he's a bit of a hero of mine, a boyhood hero, actually. I grew up, first became aware of him when he was the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, a superstar prosecutor. He was like Elliot Ness all over again. You know, I don't know much about Elliot Ness, but the Untouchables, he was famous for being so good at his job. And of course, he went from that to being mayor of New York City. Fascinating life, fascinating guy. But first, everybody, today I am happy to tell you about pancakes, my weakness. I love them. A stack of hot, fluffy, often syrupy pancakes, although I don't always use syrup. A lot of times I do, but that's another discussion. Do you have a favorite pancake brand? Aunt Jemima is no more. Can you believe that? They took her off the box. Totally ridiculous. Hey, there is a new pancake in town. It's called Cousin T's. Cousin T's was developed by my friend, Terrence K. Williams. He's a big-time Trump supporter. He's MAGA all the way, and he's got an amazing life, by the way. He grew up a foster kid. Do you know Americans tend to spend more money on dogs than foster children? It's ridiculous. It's an amazing journey he's had. This is his latest venture, he's going all the way with this. Cousin T's pancakes, they are fantastic. It's a gourmet pancake mix, totally superior to what Aunt Jemima used to be. Not only does Cousin T's make a fluffier, tastier pancake, I can see Cousin T right here on the box. He's the classic. It's an American rags-to-riches story. He was raised in foster care. He dreamed of having a fabulous family and breakfast with pancakes and all that stuff, and his dream is coming true. It's all coming together, and he's created his very own pancake company, Cousin T's. Trust me, these are the best pancakes money can buy. Go to CousinTees.com. CousinTS.com. CousinTS.com. CousinTees.com. Find out for yourself. CousinTees.com. CousinTees.com for the best pancakes this country has ever tasted. I 1,000% love these things. Oh, by the way, if you enter the promotion code GK25, you will get a 25% off discount when you check out, all right? So CousinTees.com, GK25 is the discount code, CousinTees.com. Hey, what the hell? Who doesn't love pancakes? But these are the best. And he's a fantastic guy. Cousin Tees, Terrence K. Williams, his new pancake company, Cousin Tees. Check it out at CousinTees.com. But now I bring you my conversation with America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani. Mr. Mayor, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, hey, by the way, how much time have you spent in Ukraine altogether?
Well, a lot. I would say I've been there probably on about 7, 8, 9 trips, starting in 2003 till my last trip there was in 2017.
What's it like? What's that place like?
Well, it changed over the time I was going, even in that short period. The first time I went, I addressed all the prior prime ministers. It was kind of a very formal occasion. They honored me because of September 11. And it was, Kyiv is a beautiful city with beautiful churches. You can see that. But it also, I'd say half of it looked like an old communist outpost. If you've ever been in East Berlin or any of the old communist cities, they have all these depressing buildings. And I've marked the progress of the city, how many of them have gotten rid of. So the first time I went there, there were a lot of them. But then when I went back in 06, 07, 08, it started to revive. And I'm very close to Klitschko. He was both my client in private law practice, and then I campaigned for him when he ran for mayor, when he lost and when he won. And it's kind of frustrating now. Over the last 10 days, they basically block all his calls. It's very hard for him to get out.
Have you personally met Zelensky ever?
No, I never met Zelensky. I met his Yurov, his chief of staff, and talked to Zelensky on the telephone several times, but I've never met him.
What's your sense of him from those conversations? What were you guys talking about, if you can share?
What we were talking about then was the whole situation with Biden, and would they conduct a free and fair and honest investigation of him and take the politics out of it? That was basically, and I was put together with him by the State Department. State Department asked me to meet with him because they wanted me to hear that he was basically a new person, not part of the old crooked Ukraine, that he had a background like me as a lawyer, and that he wanted to show me that Zelensky was going to make the changes so that the president would change somewhat his view of Ukraine, which was that it was very corrupt. And he kind of persuaded me.
The phone calls that you had with Zelensky, they were after the call that President Trump had with Zelensky, right?
Like when they were. Yeah. They were actually after the call, which is why I've always thought it was so stupid to say I was trying to influence him. The president had already agreed to meet with him. The president, their issues had already been resolved by the time I talked to him. The State Department put me in contact with Yermak basically just to help warm up the president's view of Ukraine. And if I had any doubts about Zelensky being straight or not being surrounded by the crooked oligarchs, they wanted to convince me that he wasn't. So we actually met in Madrid and had lunch together. And he went over with, he speaks very good English. And he is a lawyer, a real lawyer, not one of these government guys that made his money from the government.
I'm sorry, who is this again?
Yermak.
Okay.
Yermak is right now his chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And he gave me a whole list of what they were going to do to try to straighten out Ukraine. And look, you can't be sure, but when I went back, I reported to the State Department, as far as I could tell, illegitimate.
So let me ask you this. What put it in your head and Trump's that Biden was up to no good in Ukraine? I want to put it, for me, you guys, and I don't think anyone really gives you the benefit of the doubt here, Biden boasted at the Council on Foreign Relations that, you know, he threatened to withhold $1 billion unless the prosecutor was fired. And he told the story in rather dramatic terms. Now we know he's kind of lying, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we know how that really went. Did you see that? Did Trump see that and say, hey, we got something here?
No, missed it.
You missed it.
No. What happened was I was contacted by former assistant U.S. attorney, head of the criminal division, one of my assistants who was an investigator, and he said he had a source, and the source was having a hard time getting through to the Justice Department because they had a lot of information about the collusion that went on in Ukraine and that the collusion in Russia was phony and that a lot of what talking about in Russia went on in Ukraine and that some of the Steele affidavit was put together in Ukraine and that Biden was involved in it. Just that. Biden was involved in it. And I met eventually with the source. And the source told me all about how they produced phony information on Biden, on Trump Jr., but mostly on Manafort, a phony ledger book, in order to get him investigated and therefore hurt Trump. And then in the middle of it, he said, and of course, a lot of that evidence is missing because, you know, Biden bribed Poroshenko. And I said, what? And nothing, I didn't know what he was talking about. Biden bribed Poroshenko. Well, of course, everybody knows that. He said it on tape. I said, what tape? And he takes out his little phone and he shows me the famous conversation at the Council on Foreign Relations in which Biden gives a classic definition of bribery.
Now, that's, but arguably that's Biden, you could say, just boasting and that kind of thing, right? I mean, you could buy.
Well, you could, but you know what the giveaway was? He never mentioned his son.
He never mentioned his
son. So he gets up and he says, I told the president, you're not going to get your $1 billion loan guarantee unless you get rid of the prosecutor. He finishes that, very self-satisfied. They all applaud for him. And in no place does he say, my son was a defendant in that case. And I said, if you're hiding that, what we would call that as prosecutors or lawyers is a false exculpatory statement. That's sort of an intent. Why do you keep that out?
So you've heard also the phone call between Poroshenko and Biden, which to me is even more incriminating.
Yes.
I want to play that for a moment.
Yesterday, I met with the general prosecutor, Shokin.
Yes.
And despite of the fact that we didn't have any corruption charges, we don't have any information about he doing something wrong, I especially asked him, no, it was the day before yesterday, I especially asked him to resign in position as a state person. And despite of the fact that he has a support in the power. And as a finish of my meeting with him, he promised me to give me the statement on resignation. And 1 hour ago, he bring me the written statement of his resignation.
Great.
And this is my second step for keeping my promises.
I agree.
That's a legitimate call. That's not faked. That's real.
Right. And there are four more that are being withheld.
Why?
I can't speculate except I can give you the timing. So on February 1st, 2016, Shokin, who's the so-called corrupt prosecutor, that's very much exaggerated, by the way, issues an arrest warrant against a company, Burisma, that Hunter worked for, run by a very crooked Russian-oriented Ukrainian oligarch and murderer, Mykola Zloshevsky. He raids the office, closes it down, puts big signs on it, out of business. Remember that Biden's always said the investigation was dormant? You don't close down the offices in a dormant investigation. They're just lying about that. So within that month, Biden has four conversations with Poroshenko. There's no month in the 8 years he's in office where he has more than one conversation with Poroshenko. And by the end of the month, Shokin is fired. And there's no question that when the business got hit, Biden was called into action to fix the case.
Do you think that, by the way, you hear relief in Biden's voice in that call when he tells them that the prosecutor has been fired. And Poroshenko points out, even though we have nothing on him.
Yeah.
So why is Poroshenko taping that phone call?
Because they all protect themselves against what they. But the thing about Ukrainians at that crooked level, and I don't want to. I want to say something about Ukrainian crookedness because it's being used against them in a way. It's true. The upper levels of the Ukraine government are corrupt, but so is Russia, maybe more, and so are a lot of countries. Has nothing to do with the people that you see being killed. I mean, those are decent, wonderful Christian people that are being killed.
Yeah.
And they have nothing to do with corruption. It's at the higher level of the government. So, but they're all corrupt.
Sure.
And the reality is that Poroshenko, this is very hard to understand. You have to understand how crooked they are. When Biden intimidated him into dropping the case, it cost him a lot of money. Because his plan was to shake down Zloshevsky for like $100 million.
Whose plan was that? I'm sorry.
The president.
Yeah.
Poroshenko.
Okay.
Poroshenko was considered the most crooked man in Ukraine by this time. He's the guy who lost 70-30. And Biden forced his hand. So he did drop the case against Hunter. But he kept the case open against the oligarch and eventually squeezed another $100 million out of him.
Now, one of the problems, I think, for Trump, well, number one, the fake news, the swamp, everyone's against him. And this is a hard story.
It is.
And the Russian names and the Ukraine names, and nobody knows these guys, and they can't put names with
faces.
And you
can yell it down. You can just yell it down. Debunked. It was debunked.
Right.
It was debunked. Shokin was crooked. Well, so is everybody in Ukraine.
So let me ask
on that level.
When Biden was there at the Council on Foreign Relations, there's a guy named Richard Haass who runs the council with him.
Sure, we know him well.
The president, nice guy.
Yeah.
However, he's a member of the establishment.
Big time.
And I saw him once, and I said, "You were there. What was your reaction to that phone call?" I mean, he admitted it right in front of you, and he said, "Well, the entire interagency, that was the policy of the European Union and the interagency to get rid of that prosecutor."
All made up. Before he was fired, before Shokin was fired, there was no investigation. First of all, there never was an investigation. I mean, I've been through the entire prosecutorial file possessed by Ukraine. There's not a single report of a single act of corruption on the part of Shokin. He's never been charged with it. He's never been accused of it. He's never been civilly charged with it. So, plus, if you look at his lifestyle, if he was corrupt, he was the most inept, corrupt guy you ever saw. He lives in a simple little house with a simple little car, and the rest of these guys are driving around in Bentleys, and the Ukrainians do not act subtle about their corruption. For some reason, it's a badge of honor. the more corrupt you are, the more powerful you are. I spent a lot of time with Shokin. If the guy is corrupt, he's petty corrupt. You know, he's like, he sold a couple of prosecutor's offices for $2,000 or $3,000. He's not getting $100 million bribes.
Yeah.
And that conversation that you hear really confirms 10 witnesses that I have. Even people that don't like him, people who think he was inept, say, worst problem with Shokin is he was lazy and inept. The guy was one of the most honest guys we had. And the reason he turned is because they did the corruption thing. He was willing to keep his mouth shut and make the deal and get out so the country could get the money. And Lutsenko took over for him. And they all promised him they weren't going to ruin his reputation. You know, he's suing the government. He's suing Biden in Ukraine for libel.
The phone call with Zelensky takes place. Here's my sense of the atmospherics beyond Zelensky and Trump. You know, the swamp is out to get Trump. He's been villainized and demonized by the fake news. So the moment, and there are about 20 people on this call, including, what's his name, Vindman. The moment Trump mentions Biden, they're like, the most inappropriate, horrible thing we've ever heard. Now we got him, right?
Yeah, and then they lied about it. They lied about the conversation. This is typical of them, right? They lied about they made the conversation much worse than it was, if you remember. They said, the first thing that came out was, there's a guy who heard the conversation, whistleblower says Trump intimidated him. Trump threatened him with holding back the money. Trump tried to frighten him. Almost all the things that Biden did in his conversation. Now, that's why Trump immediately put out a transcript.
Yeah.
Because the transcript shows a conversation in which, first of all, the money never came up. In fact, the money wasn't even on the table yet. It was 2 weeks later that the money came up. Money wasn't even on the table. He didn't hold out for a meeting and say, you have to do this, that. He gave him a meeting immediately. It was a friendly conversation. And the way he introduced looking at Biden was in a kind of humble way. Would you please look at? And wouldn't he have a right to do that if you assume the allegations need to be investigated? This is crime at the highest levels of two governments. It's a vice president and a president of a country who are engaged in a bribe. Plus, it affects the relationship between, it affects the relationship with Ukraine now. Every time Biden would go to Ukraine and talk about corruption, the Ukrainians would laugh at him.
Right.
They all know. Everybody in Ukraine knows it's true.
Let me take a big picture look at this, stepping back. You know, when I look at Biden, I see a guy right now who seems a bit haunted. Here he is. He has everything he ever wanted. He's president of the United States. He doesn't look, I'm talking beyond his health problems. He doesn't seem to be enjoying it. I think you can almost see a cloud over his head. I think he knows he's compromised, and he's on thin ice. Is that a fair? Do you see what I see when you look at him?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, he's the stuff on him that hasn't come out is. Who knows what it is? I mean, I only have, when I look at the hard drive is, we call it a hard drive. It's really Hunter Biden's computer. And it's a computer he used for about a 6-year period for maybe 60% of his business. So there's another 40% that we don't have, right? And so what I have, I would have to give it like general numbers. But it's got, I assure you, a very, very well-sourced RICO case that could be brought against the Biden crime family for 30 years because he describes the 30-year arrangement in it. And then, so you go back to when they were getting money as from banks and little money, and then the shakedown in Iraq when his brother James got a big housing contract in Iraq when he was the point man for Iraq. And we've talked about Ukraine, the $3.5 million from the mayor of Moscow's wife who was close to Putin.
It's all in there.
Yeah, and $31 million from China.
And by
Chinese way, communists.
When Biden got up at that debate and said it's been debunked, it's Russian disinformation, and 95 intelligence agencies are saying, oh, no, five former CIA directors, including Republicans, are saying that, that's when you, number one, he is lying. Number two, the swamp is covering for him because those CIA directors did put out a statement that suggested as much.
I resent that personally. I resent that in every way possible. I mean, they accused me of being a Russian agent. And now it turns out it's all true. It's all been vindicated by not only by Miranda Devine's book, but by Schweiker's book,
yeah,
where he went and got the records. I mean, he has the records of the $31 million that went from the Chinese communist to Joe, and Joe got 50% of it.
Can I ask you this? You've been friendly with reporters over the years, right?
At times.
And like a reporter you're friendly with at the New York Times. I don't know if you still. I don't want to even talk about Maggie Haberman, but
I'm very friendly with Maggie.
So she's a smart person.
And she knows I'm not a crook. She knows I'm an honest person.
Well, exactly. So, and she has to know that this laptop is real, that this is dynamite stuff, yet they don't pursue it, or they just say it's been debunked. It's much ado. Why is that? Is it because, you know, everybody knows in the swamp, wherever, Trump's bad. That's the marching orders. Got to take. Why? What is?
Greg, I have to believe that, right? I have to believe that they are intimidated. I mean, the people ask me about Barr. Barr didn't want to have happen to him what happened to me.
Right.
I mean, they gave some pretty heavy threats against Barr. They were going to indict him. They were going to disbar him. They're going to ruin his career. He saw that they were effective in doing that.
And for anybody who says, and I've been thinking about Barr a lot, and I watched that report, well, Barr doesn't have to write a book. I mean, he's rich. He's a partner in a law firm. He was he's got plenty of money. He's only 72 years old, I think. He was born in 1950, so he's 72 this year. A 72-year-old man who's been a lawyer for most of his life and even a good chunk in private practice isn't necessarily set for life, are they?
No, I'm not going to say Bill, I'm sure, is doing better than most Americans, but he's not rich. I mean,
and he's got to worry about money, even somebody like that.
Sure. This book could make him $5, $6, $7 million. I mean, that's a lot of money.
And he needs it, probably.
I think he does need it.
And if he did not write that book and make these statements, I do think that he would be canceled. Or the,
Yeah, everybody forget him. Now he's relevant, at least. They'll put him on MSNBC and CNBC, and all the people that have lied and tried to frame Trump will use him. He's like, to me, he's like, I hate to say it because I dealt with him in law enforcement, he's like a rat.
What really kind of worries me is that there are so few people like you who are willing to stand up. Well, does that worry you?
Yeah, sure. Sure, it worries me, but I put it aside.
What about, like, you worked with great prosecutors. They worked for you.
Right.
At the U.S. Attorney's Office. I guess those guys are in private practice right now. I guess I'll just say, I know people are scared. People, number one, let's face it, Trump freaks people out.
Right.
He does. And you can believe the worst about Trump. Like, okay, you hear it again and again and again that this guy's a monster. This guy's this is that. Like, you got to say, well, all right, we can't have this guy. There are people who believe that. Good people
there
who believe that.
There's no doubt about it. There are people that think that his personality, and I, since I've known him for a long time, and it's hard for me to completely assess that and understand it. Now, when I look back on it, where we are today, I say to myself, how stupid is that? I mean, I'd rather take his personality and people not and children not being killed in Ukraine.
Yeah, wow.
Because we know that this would not have happened under him. I mean, 64% of the American people, many of them don't like Trump, just said it wouldn't have happened under Trump. I don't think there's an intelligent person that thinks it would happen under Trump. The best proof of it is it didn't. It happened under Bush. He took territory under Bush, pushed him aside, took territory under Obama, pushed him aside, and now he's making a complete fool out of Biden. He wouldn't have tested Trump. And that alone, I'll put up with the emails and the texts. Plus, we were energy independent. We're now not. That's totally crazy that we're not energy independent. That helps. Biden, I did a podcast on what Biden could do, short of going to war, to limit Putin. He's done none of it. I cut off the oil.
By the way, did you ever meet Putin?
Yes.
When and where?
I met him the first time at Ground Zero when he came to visit, to make a ceremonial visit, and he was very appropriate. Some weren't, but he was very appropriate. He impressed me with the fact that we had a joint concern, meaning us and Russia, with Islamic terrorism. He tried to explain to me how it's even worse in Chechnya. How they're more vicious even than, it was hard for me to believe you could be more vicious than what I had in front of me, and he invited me to see him when I came to Russia, which I did. And it happened to be right around the time of Beslan, when the kids were all killed by the Islamic terrorists.
They put the gas in the theater?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the exact timing of it.
2003, I think it
was.
Yeah,
but it was a kind of a ceremonial meeting. And I spent about 30 minutes with him, and he wanted to impress me again, probably to get back to Bush. He wanted to impress me again with his concern about Islamic terrorism and how we're on the same side. I walked away somewhat impressed. My first impression was, that was when Bush said he saw a soul in his eyes. I went back and told people I saw a stone cold killer. I mean, I saw a very cold guy, reminded me of a lot of the murderers I dealt with, right? But I saw a very smart guy, and I thought a guy you could deal with. When he did the second piece with me about how we have a joint interest in Islamic terrorism, I kind of bought that a bit. I said, yeah, that could be an area in which we could work with him. I go back to my hotel. I have to travel to the Urals afterwards. And all of a sudden...
The what? I'm sorry, the where?
The Urals. I had to go to town.
The mountains.
Yeah, the mountains. I was advising a steel company that wanted to go private and giving a speech. All of a sudden, there's a report on television that he gave a speech the next day. And he announced that every one of the governors were no longer going to be elected. They're going to be appointed by him. And I'm thinking to myself, what the heck does that have to do with Chechnya? There's only one area of, maybe in one area you declare martial law, but you don't take the right of election away from the entire country. And it's the first time I started to see how he does this PSYOPs thing. He tries to convince you that he has Western values, and then he shakes you up with these other actions. So I wouldn't discount right now that he's putting out reports that he's mentally unstable. And I do think that Lavrov has deliberately puts the word possibility of nuclear war in there to play on us. I think it's a PSYOPs operation to frighten the West. And seeing Biden as a little coward to completely cancel him out. Now, I wouldn't want to risk the world on that calculation, but I think that's something that's being left out of the equation. Like I talked to a guy who knows him 2 days ago, not really well, don't particularly like him, but he knows him. And I said, is he acting differently? He said, I can't tell. He said, I think he is. But then he said to me, you can't discount the fact that he's acting differently in order to shake you up.
Right? Yeah.
Because what's the two things we think about in nuclear war? Mutually assured destruction means that no sane person is going to touch that button. Because I touch the button, you destroy me. I destroy you. The only risk, Ronald Reagan used to say this, is an insane person having their finger on the button, which is why I oppose Iran getting it with the Ayatollah.
Sure. Can I ask you this? Back to Biden for a moment. He is under federal, Hunter is under federal investigation, or I think Hunter said it was a tax audit. What's going on with that?
I don't know. It seems like they're investigating him for things.
Send Kevin in if you would.
There are things, they're investigating him for things that seem a lot more complicated than things that are right in front of them. Like, why aren't they investigating him for money laundering? He's got a transaction in 2016. It's all there on paper. I gave him the paper a year and a half before the election, by the way, not to interfere with the election. I gave him all the papers. There's a document that goes from Ukraine. The money gets transferred.
But the evidence is there. But
yeah.
I mean,
why aren't they investigating that?
Is it a serious investigation? Is it a real one?
I don't know. If it was a serious investigation, they would be investigating that. I'm going to tell you why they're not investigating that. It demonstrates absolutely clearly that Hunter, Devin Archer, the company was involved in a $3.4 million, for them, money laundering transaction. Little side note, $800,000 for Joe. That's why they're not investigating. They don't want that side note to come out. Joe got a piece of that when he was vice president of the United States of America. So that thing's been covered up. It's in the FBI's possession. How do you not? Now let's assume that that was put there maliciously, or you got to investigate it, Greg, right? You can't just conclude, oh, it says $800,000 for Joe. That would be the logical reason they'd be paying money. You wouldn't be paying money to Hunter. You'd be paying money for Joe's influence. Or to Kerry. They were also paying money to Kerry's son-in-law.
So,
or stepson.
Can you just, why wouldn't hungry prosecutors, you know, ethical prosecutors, crimes should not be committed. We have all kinds of laws about even governing the appearance of impropriety and regulations. Why is this not being pursued? Or why, well, it might be being pursued, but why wasn't it pursued already?
Because he's in that category, like Hillary Clinton, where somehow or other they fix cases for them. I don't know why. I don't know what they have over the Justice
Department. Did you see that when you were in the Justice Department?
Never. Never. In January of 2016, after giving my information to the State Department 8 months earlier, and they did nothing with it, I finally Barr said he would look at it.
In January of 2020.
Of 2020. Did I say 2016? 2020. January of 2020. And he selected the U.S. attorney in Pittsburgh. And he said that we could go and give him all our evidence. And that they were not going to burden Durham with that, but they were going to have separate prosecutors. So Bob Costello, my attorney, who helped me get the hard drive and analyze it, went and visited with the U.S. attorney there. It was a U.S. attorney, a couple of young assistant U.S. attorneys, very much like the ones I remembered from when I was an FBI agent, very much like the FBI agents I was used to, not these political guys. They were very excited about it. We spent 5 hours with them. I brought a slideshow with me, and I had about 40 slides, so I made it easy for them to follow it. I brought documents with me showing about 8 different bribes, and I had a whole analysis of every time he's a point man, America loses, and the Biden family gets millions. This can't be a coincidence. Can't be a coincidence. They make him a point man in Iraq. He fails in Iraq. They get into a $1.5 billion deal. He stays in Ukraine. He's supposed to deal with corruption and get Russia out. Fails. They make about $14 million, actually, if you count it all up. He gets involved with Russia. We don't know how much he made in Russia. Bare minimum, $3.5 million. And then they make him point man for China to deal with the expansion into the islands. So he's going to cut them back and to work on them with tariffs. And they get a $1.5 billion commitment to this phony private equity firm.
Real quick, where do they keep their money? Because Joe has assets, but they're not insane assets. Frank lives, I think, somewhat modestly on the surface. Hunter is always complaining about a lack of money in a lot of these emails.
Hunter blows a lot of it.
Right. I mean, where is the money? I mean,
The money is, first of all, it's far less than you would imagine because a lot of it gets wasted. I mean, over the years, one of the problems you see in the hard drive is putting controls on Hunter.
Hmm.
I mean, Hunter basically has an informal now guardian. And Hunter can't, you'll see a lot of complaints in the latter years of Hunter saying, I can't get my hands on my money. I can't get my hands on my money because Daddy finally put a stop to it. So a lot of that money got blown.
Who is that informal guardian? Do we know?
Schwerner, his name.
Okay.
I think it's Eric Schwerner. And but there are witnesses who have never been questioned, who claim that they have the numbers and the access to the offshore bank accounts. There's a prosecutor in Ukraine who's attempted to get to the United States for years. Nobody will investigate him. Nobody will bring him here. There's a woman who said her life was in jeopardy. We brought that to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney, when I first presented the case to the U.S. attorney, the four-hour case, they were very excited. They reminded me of my assistant U.S. attorneys when we first looked at the commission case, or we first looked at the Stanley Friedman case. Prosecutors get excited about cases like that. These kids were excited. They said, we'll be back to you. I said, I've got a lot more documents. I didn't want to burn you with them. They got back to Bob. We sent them more documents. They interviewed, we gave them the whistleblower. They interviewed him. They found him credible. 4 weeks later, we don't hear from them. Bob calls him. Oh, we'll get back to you. 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 That was it.
Hmm.
It ended in, it began in January. It ended in February. And it's a case that, gosh, I did this for a living. There were 10 cases that could be made there, and they were very, very strong cases. And there were things that couldn't be avoided, like Hunter actually almost pleading for help, saying, I'm a danger to the children, telling his father, I'm a danger to the children. And then pictures, very compromising pictures of young girls that normally the FBI, I mean, they're almost obligated to go visit and find out what this is about. They didn't do that.
It's amazing. Hey, I want to take another step back, if you don't mind. Where were you born?
I was born in Brooklyn.
What hospital?
Midwood Hospital. It was a birthing type hospital right near Kings County, but it was designed for pregnancies. It doesn't exist any longer.
And your mother and father, what were their names?
Helen and Harold Giuliani.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I did not. I was born 8-9 years into their marriage because they had trouble conceiving. They lost one baby by a stillborn, but a problem in birth. She didn't think she could ever have a baby. They stopped doing whatever they were doing, and then all of a sudden I was born.
When did your mother die?
My mother died late. My mother died in a year after 9/11.
Wow. So she saw you become mayor and everything.
Oh, yeah. She was a pip. She used to call up the press and argue with them. My mother was a very, very intelligent woman, very well-read teacher. She loved English and history. She sort of developed my interest in reading from the time I was 2-3 years old. And she's very political. And she was the Republican. My father was a Democrat. My father became a Republican on his own after Kennedy, you know. But at the original, he was sort of labor union, poor people, drilled into me that, you know, Democrats are for the poor and Republicans are for the rich, all of which is myth now.
You moved to Long Island?
We moved to Long Island when I was 7 because my neighborhood was changing, getting really bad. Some of my
And that was Midwood? I'm sorry, what was that? What was the neighborhood?
We were in Flatbush.
Flatbush, yeah.
We moved to Garden City South.
What street in Garden City South?
Houston Road.
That's south of Nassau Boulevard, one street, right?
I used to take the Nassau Boulevard station to Bishop Lockland High School every day. I used to walk from Houston Road up to Nassau Boulevard, and I'd get on the 650 train, and it let me off in downtown Brooklyn, and I walked 6 blocks to Bishop Lockland High School.
If you were walking to the Nassau Boulevard train station, you were pretty close to Garden City.
Of course I was.
You're Garden City South. You were only a block or so away, right?
Oh, correct.
And
I was a charter member of the Garden City Little League.
Where did you go to grammar school?
I went to grammar school originally at St. Francis of Assisi in Brooklyn, then St. Anne's Grammar School in Stuart Manor, and then I went to Bishop Lockland High School in Brooklyn. So I ended up commuting as a 13-year-old to high school.
Why did you? Yeah, there were high schools on Long Island. Why did you go to
Bishop
the one
Lockland
in
High School? Was a diocesan school. You took a test for it. The top two or three people in the test were awarded a scholarship to the high school. And my cousin went there, and it was considered at that time the best high school in the Brooklyn Diocese before they separated into two dioceses. So it was like an honor to go there.
Yeah.
And when you thought about it, a lot of the kids I went to school with lived in New York, and they traveled an hour on the subway, and I traveled 45 minutes on the Long Island Railroad like I was a businessman.
I was in awe of you guys. I knew a couple of people who went to Regis High School, and they commuted in the city, and I just thought that
Regis,
was the coolest
Regis
thing
Regis was
in the
similar
world.
For the Diocese of New York.
What were your favorite subjects?
History, without a doubt. Although at one time, among the many careers I wanted to follow was being a doctor, so biology was a big subject. I wanted to be a priest.
Why did you go to Manhattan College?
I went to Manhattan College because I wasn't going to college. I was going to the seminary. When I graduated from high school, I was signed up for the Montfort Fathers Seminary in Bayshore, New York. They're a missionary order dedicated to the Blessed Mother, and they're very big, for example, in Haiti. They're the missionaries in Haiti, in the French-speaking places, you know, in the world that are in trouble and in difficulties. And I began that devotion about 2 years before I left high school. So I spent half my high school life wanting to be a priest, and the other half of my high school life not knowing what I wanted to do. But by the time I graduated, I had been accepted into the seminary. And if you look at my high school yearbook, there are all kinds of good luck in the seminary, good luck as a missionary, I hope you don't get killed in Africa, all kinds of crazy stuff. And I took the summer off, got a job, and then I started thinking about, could I keep the vows? Because I started going to the beach, and I started thinking about girls, and I had a crush on this girl, and I went to visit the head of the admissions for the Montfort Fathers. They're out in Bayshore, it used to be. And I explained my issue to him. He's a very kind, wonderful man. And he said, you know, you should just put it aside and come back in 2 years. I wanted to go, but I said, I have this strong... He said, well, this happens a lot. And sometimes you come back and sometimes you don't. I said, but I don't have a college to go to. He said, well, you went to Bishop Lockland, that big Christian brothers. I bet they take you to Manhattan College. Let me give them a call. So I got in, and I got into the pre-med program because that was open. So I started off as a pre-med student, and then I switched to liberal arts.
Did you commute?
I did. I commuted from Well, then from North Belmore, because by that time we had moved from Garden City South to North Belmore. So I drove in by car every day, often with Alan Placa, my friend forever, and Peter Powers. They've been my friend since high school. Eventually, Peter was my campaign manager, yeah. and Alan is my life, is Monsignor now, lifetime friend.
College, pre-med, liberal arts. When did you decide I want to be a lawyer?
Probably toward the end of my junior year of college, I took a test given to me by a psychology professor who was my advisor, because I was so confused about what I wanted to be. I wanted to be in the Air Force. I was in the ROTC. I wanted to fly. It turned out I had broken eardrums, so I couldn't qualify. I thought my life was over. When that happened, I thought my life was complete. All I wanted to do was fly, and my life, I've never accomplished anything. So I took a aptitude test, and when it came back, it said, one of the things that you're best at being a lawyer, because you have a very logical mind, you know how to organize things well. So they had a whole bunch of things you'd be good at. One of them was not doctor, but one of them was lawyer. And Jerry, who was my teacher also for two different courses, said, you know, you'd be perfect at that, because you love to argue, and you argue logically, and you explain things logically. And that's what it's about. And you're a good writer. And people don't realize that being a lawyer is a lot about writing. Mm. And I said, well, gee, okay, but I don't know. So I got a scholarship to NYU. And therefore, I thought, well, let me go and I'll see. And after 2 days in law school, I fell in love with it.
Okay.
And it's been a passion since then.
When you, NYU, by the way, back then, now it's top five law schools in the country. What kind of reputation?
It was a good law school then. Yeah. Let's say in the top 20 at that point. Not in the top five.
And you went right into law school after?
And I went there. I could have gone to Columbia, but I went there because of a scholarship, and my family wasn't rich, and they paid for the education. I mean, if I had gotten a scholarship to Columbia or Harvard, I probably would have gone there. But I never regret the education I got at NYU was the equivalent of any place in the world.
And you went right after college?
I did.
Okay.
3 years right away.
3 years. And your first job after law school?
Law clerk to Lloyd S. McMahon, who was my second father. He became my mentor. I remained close to him until he died.
He was a federal judge?
Yeah, he was a federal judge. He had been appointed by Eisenhower. Let's just see some of the connections. He was the man who prosecuted Frank Costello. He argued the Rosenberg case on appeal in the Second Circuit. He was a very, very, he was a veteran of the war. And he worked with General Donovan in the original CIA.
Wow.
He was a very, very exceptional man. And he took great interest in his law clerks, in teaching them. And I would say I ended up being one of his favorites, because we just hit it off.
Real quick, you mentioned you were fixated, you wanted to be a pilot. When were you exposed to aviation? I mean, when did you,
No idea. Okay. I have no idea. I joined the ROTC, and then they had all these courses on aerodynamics, and I started studying it, and I just loved it.
Okay. I thought General Donovan, the same Donovan, Donovan who was...
No, this was before. Okay. This is before I...
Sure. And how long did you clerk?
In those days, it was a two-year clerkship. So I clerked for 2 years. You were a junior clerk and then a senior clerk. My senior clerk was Paul Crotty, who's now a federal judge, a very distinguished federal judge, but also...
Political family.
Yeah, but he was my chief lawyer when I became mayor. Hmm. He had worked for Ed Koch, and he had been commissioner of housing for Koch, and I needed people who understood city government, so I appointed him corporation counsel, which is one of the most important positions in the city, even though he was a Democrat.
After the clerkship is over, where do you go?
I went immediately to the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Southern District,
and I immediately was thrown into trying cases because Judge McMahon trained me. He loves to train you, so he trained me to be a trial lawyer.
Who was the U.S. Attorney then?
Originally, it was Bob Morgenthau, but Morgenthau left before I started, so I started under Whitney North Seymour. And then Paul Curran.
Seymour. Give me his full name again. Whitney North. Yeah. I remember him actually as a little kid. So what is your favorite case from that era when you were an assistant U.S. attorney?
Has to be prosecuting Congressman Podell. Burt Podell, who was a predecessor of Schumer's, that district. I prosecuted him for bribery, and I got him to confess on the witness stand. which ended up on the front page of the New York Times, my first time on the front page of the New York Times, where I was described as Perry Mason-like.
So he gets on the stand, has no intention of giving up his making this admission.
And we cross-examined him for 2 days, and we caught him in so many lies, one after the other, that he eventually called time out and pled guilty.
Wow.
And the reason for it? I think we may have discussed him before. My co-counsel on that case was later on Judge Mukasey, Attorney General Mukasey. He was my Michael, although older than me, was 2 years behind me in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I trained him. He was my assistant. And we practiced cross-examination of him for 4 or 5 days. And Michael played Podell. So when I got up to cross-examine Podell, I went down about 30 IQ levels right from Michael. Huh. Michael was wicked to cross-examine. I couldn't get anything out of him. But then I used the same techniques I used on Michael against this guy, and he had half the intelligence of Michael, and was a big liar.
Oh, man.
And he just kept making up stories. And I actually came to the conclusion that politicians are the best people to cross-examine because they get away with lying so much they become sloppy. They used to say, well, you see it sometimes just in, you see the stupid things they say, you can just easily go out and contradict it. And because they get away with it. They get away with just spinning the moment. But when you're in court and he says, oh, there were two law firms, that didn't go to that law firm. So then you get out all the records. Oh, show me the other law firm. Here's Martindale. Here's this. Here's that. Here's this. Here's that. Yeah. Here's this. Here's that.
I love it.
And by the time you're finished, you say, Congressman, would you like to change that testimony?
Mm-hmm. Spinning the moment. That's what Joe Biden does all the time.
Well, you
whatever
get Joe,
feels
that's
good.
Why I used to say, let me prosecute that RICO case. I'll get him.
Two quick things. At the U.S. Attorney's Office, Mukasey, I believe, went to Yale Law School. You went to NYU. There are a lot of Ivy Leaguers. Is that a thing?
A little too much. A little bit like the Supreme Court. When I became U.S. Attorney, I used to use that against them. Hmm. Like, I'd come up with a case, like let's say the commission case, which a lot of people thought was too ambitious, too hard to do. We would fail. And I said, and I had them all around, sitting around, all the top guys. And I said, you know, you guys are a bunch of geniuses. Now, unlike maybe the guys you and I hung out with and grew up with, a lot of people would be kind of humble about that. And they'd say, no, but they look at me back. Yeah, we are geniuses. I said, well, if you're geniuses, you can do miracles. And that's what we're going to do. We're going to do miracles. And I used to challenge them based on their arrogance. And I think I turned them into much better lawyers. I also did something that was very controversial at the request of Ed Koch. When I became U.S. attorney, I went around to everybody in New York City that, like Republicans, I said, what can I do to help? And Koch and Congressman Green, who was a Republican, he said, we have a terrible problem with drug cases. And they go into the state court and they're let out in 3 hours and the people are back out on the street and everybody thinks the cops are corrupt because the cop arrests them, the guy's back in 3 hours, they think they paid off the cop. And it's really the crazy judges like Let 'Em Loose Bruce, remember?
Yep.
He said you could concentrate like on one area, and that time it was Alphabet City, and you could bring the feds in and you could really make an impact. So working with Ben Ward, he turned over cops to me and DEA agents. One day a week, we'd arrest everybody on the Lower East Side. And we'd bring them into federal court. It was called Federal Day. And they'd all go to prison. we had things like, we changed the day. So we'd go out on Federal Day on Tuesday, and we'd start getting offered bribes to come back the next day.
Let me ask you this. So you get that conviction. You're an assistant U.S. attorney. The next, you're sent to DOJ headquarters, right?
Yeah. My Judge McMahon, I said, was the judge I clerked for. Judge Tyler, who was a judge in the Southern District, gets appointed deputy attorney general under Edward Levy during the Ford administration to clean up the Justice Department post-Watergate. And Judge McMahon recommends me to Judge Tyler, and Judge Tyler hires me. And I become his chief of staff. And then after that, his law partner for when we were together for the next 7 years.
Real quick, did the Justice Department need cleaning up after Watergate? I mean, the perception that I have off the top of my head is, I mean, they were emboldened to go after Republicans. I mean, they were who decided that it needed cleaning up, and what was the problem?
It was very, very different then. The cleaning up that it needed really was that an awful lot of things that had to be subjected to, like they would do warrantless, almost like they're doing now. They would do warrantless taps and
It was almost the excesses of the 60s, actually, right?
The church committee brought it all out. And some of it was a bit exaggerated, but some of it was real.
So you're the number three guy at the Justice Department.
Right, and I helped. No, I was then...
First the chief of staff.
Then 4 years later, the number three guy.
And that's a Senate-confirmed spot?
Yes.
What was your title?
Associate Attorney General.
And with that, I mean, that's heady stuff. How old are you?
39.
Oh, 39. All right, so you're not like...
Not a baby. Right,
right, right. Right.
And a lot of experience. And during that, people will remember this, during that Levy era, we invented FISA. That's where the idea of FISA came about. It eventually got made into a law by the Carter administration, but it's the Ford administration that developed it as an administrative agency. And I helped to formulate FISA. That's why one of the reasons I took up his defense was because I knew FISA so well. And it was outraged by the fact that they fooled around with a FISA.
His defense is in Trump's defense.
Yeah. I mean, a FISA affidavit in the Justice Department was almost like a religious act because it was all the power was in your hands. So if I write an affidavit for a wiretap on Fat Tony Salerno, the defense lawyer is going to get to challenge it and find out if I screwed up. If I write a wire on Greg Kelly, national security wire, nobody ever gets to see it, ever. And what we did, what Ed Levy did and Tyler, we set up a whole group of ethical rules. You got to corroborate that three more times than you would a normal one. So when Comey said that it wasn't corroborated, immediately I said to myself, because you didn't corroborate it.
Right.
I mean, you're the FBI. That's what you do. You corroborate things. So the thing said that they went and got a passport in the consul's office in Miami, the Russian consul's office in Miami. All you had to do is check. There is no Russian consul's office in Miami. It's a complete lie, right in the. But it's also laziness. They never bothered to check. They just took it and put the crap in.
So, by the way, did you work with Gerald Ford? Did you get to meet him, spend time with him?
Not. Yes, I did work with him, but I never really got to know him. I got to know Ronald Reagan very well, but I didn't get to know him.
So you, how did you get to know Reagan? Because let's say Ford leaves in 77.
I go to private practice, Patterson, Belknap, yeah. Webb, and Tyler, with Judge Tyler and Mike Mukasey, my partner. And then when Reagan gets elected, I get appointed the number three person in the Justice Department.
Again.
No, this time I was appointed to the job of my boss.
Okay.
I had been the chief of staff.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Now I'm in charge. And I got to work with President Reagan right away on law enforcement speeches. I would draft them. I'd give them to his speech writers. Then I would talk to him. I had one of the saddest or most interesting days of my life was I had breakfast with him the morning he was shot. And I have a picture of it that my mother always kept and finally gave it. I have a picture shaking hands with him that morning. And I was also, although I was also the person that got Hinckley out of the hands of the Metropolitan Police, because they originally arrested Hinckley because the Secret Service was worried about him. They didn't grab him. And the Attorney General Smith, was very worried that we'd have a Lee Harvey Oswald, because the Metropolitan Police at that time isn't what it was today.
Sure.
It was a really shaky police force.
Real quick, your law firm, was that D.C.-based or New York-based?
New York.
New York-based.
I represented, believe it or not, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Daily News. I did a lot of libel work. I did civil litigation. I represented a few criminal cases.
So I think it's March 30th of 1981. Reagan is shot. You have breakfast with him. I'd love to see that picture.
Yeah.
So what was he like?
Spend the night in court waiting for Hinckley to be. I end the night at midnight with Hinckley being arraigned in federal court with Judge Webster, who was the head of the FBI.
William Webster.
Yeah.
Wow.
Great, great director of the FBI.
Should
we use him back?
I think he died.
Yeah.
And then he was director of the CIA, too. What was Reagan like?
You can't say enough about him. First of all, he was a hell of a lot smarter than anybody ever realized. And I realized that the first time I worked with him, I drafted a speech. I gave it to his chief speech writer. I thought I'd never see it again because, you know, guys in the agencies, they don't pay attention to them. The speechwriters take it over. All of a sudden, I get a call from Mike Uelman, who was his chief. President wants to see you. I'd go over the speech. I come in. He has it all marked up in his own handwriting. You know, I'm one of these Eastern guys who didn't. I loved him. I loved his speeches, but I thought, oh, he's an actor who, you know. It was, he made real improvements in it. He worked on the, he was a good writer. I ask people if they want to assess Reagan's intellect, read his love letters to his wife that were written by him. The writing is excellent. It's very, very good writing. He improved his speeches and had a sense of it. It wasn't just an actor. He had a way with the language. And from that moment on, I started to realize, boy, they're really underestimating this guy. This is a very bright guy. His calm personality, his understated humor, kind of, you know, kind of masked that a bit. But a lot of these achievements that he made came about because he'd been thinking about them for, like, he had thought through mutually assured destruction. To him, it was immoral. To him, the idea of the world surviving because two people could destroy it and it's going to remain that way safe is immoral with regard to the, you know, lives of the rest of the people in the world. That had to be changed. The Soviet Union was to him a monster. I mean, it was what it is. It is what Putin is right now. And to him, to him, we should not, he never agreed with the idea of living with it. He felt that if we live with it, eventually they destroy us.
So you're young, you're very successful, you're working with presidents. Do you have a life plan for yourself charted out in your head? You know, I want to do something. I want to be in politics. I want to go back to private. Like, what is your life
plan? My life plan, right before I became offered the job Associate Attorney General, my greatest goal in life would have been to be U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York, where I had been an assistant U.S. attorney for 5 or 6 years, a law clerk for 2 years. It was like my home. All my best friends at this point came from the U.S. Attorney's office because you get very, very close. I spent so much time there. You always have ideas on how you could do it better, what you could do with it because you were there. Probably kind of like your dad wanting to be police commissioner. You're in the police department, and you start thinking, well, maybe I can do that, and your life gets attached to it. But when I was offered the job of Associate Attorney General, I actually thought, oh, my goodness, I kind of passed that job up if I do this, because the Associate Attorney is in charge of the U.S. attorneys.
Yeah.
And I kind of felt bad, but I thought, I can't pass this up. I love doing this work, and to work at that level in Washington with great people that I like. But then all of a sudden, after 2.5 years, the U.S. attorney decides to leave. I have to pick the new U.S. attorney. That's my job. That was my office's job. I picked 93 of them, 92 of them, with the president and the attorney general. And we're going through names, and it all of a sudden occurs to me, I want to do that. So I go see, I knew if I went to Bill Smith immediately, he would thought I was crazy. Why do you want to take a demotion? You know, be like you had your own radio show, and you say, I only want to be on once a week. I'll go back to once a week or something. So I go see Ed Schmolz, who's from New York, the deputy attorney general, and I explain it to him because I knew he would know the significance of the U.S. attorney's office. He said, I know what you want to do. I know you and I know New York. But Bill and the president are going to think you're crazy. We're going to have to explain this to them. So he goes with me to the attorney general, and the first thing he does say, are you okay? Are you happy here? Can we make your job better? I got it through to him, and he explained it to the president. And then I went to Al D'Amato and asked him if he would support me, and he did. And in 3 months, I became U.S. attorney. And during that 3 months, I read Joe Bonanno's book. And when I read Joe Bonanno's book, I got the idea of the commission case.
Joe Bonanno was, again, who?
Joe Bonanno was the head of one of the original members of the commission way back in 19...
Crime Commission.
Crime Commission. And Mafia Crime Commission.
Was this his memoirs?
It was a... Yeah. It was like one of these stupid things to do. He always saw himself as a businessman. That Italians were forced into this because they were discriminated against. And we were no different, he would say, than... you know, the commission was like the Security Council of the UN. They had these grandiose... Paul Castellano had this same thing. This is a grandiose version of themselves.
But so he makes himself vulnerable with this book.
He makes himself vulnerable because, very carefully, everything is beyond the statute of limitations, and he doesn't admit murder. But here's, he didn't know the RICO statute.
Okay, yeah, right.
So the RICO statute allows you to prosecute the business of crime. So what he wrote about those 30 years, he established the business.
I got to check out this book. I'd love it.
All I had to do is take it from 1963, where he ended it, or 65, and bring it up to date. And I used him as a witness and then put him in jail.
Now, did you think, okay, your life plan is to be U.S. attorney. Do you think beyond that? I mean, Morgenthau, you know, Dewey goes from D.A. to, you know.
Not then.
No? Okay.
First time I thought about public office was during the Friedman case. I was in New Haven, and it was all about New York City, about Friedman and Manus and all this money they were. And I was kind of walking along by myself on the Yale Square, because it's right connected, the courthouse is right next to Yale. And I'm thinking, you know, if I were a U.S. attorney, maybe I could clean things up. I know everything about crime. I mean, if I were mayor, I could really clean things up. I know everything about crime. I know everything about corruption. And maybe I should run for mayor sometime. That would be really terrific. I could straighten out the city. And then immediately I said to myself, oh, I'm a Republican. Yeah, the last Republican got 5% or something.
Right? Can't be done, right.
Can't be done. I talked myself out of it. Toward the end of my U.S. attorney's period, Senator McConnell, McCain, D'Amato wanted me to run against Senator Moynihan. They actually came to me and offered it to me.
Mitch McConnell came.
He sent them.
He sent who? I'm sorry.
McCain and D'Amato.
Okay.
And they wanted me to run against
Moynihan.
Now, first of all, I love Moynihan.
Yeah.
It would have been impossible for me to run against. We had become good friends. But he agreed to my nomination as well, and came to it, and we became good friends because we both love opera. Hmm. And the first question he asked me, because he heard that I loved opera, he said, "Who's buried at the old St. Patrick's Cathedral?" I said, "Lorenzo DePonte." He said, "I think only you and me know that." And we became great friends. And I would go visit him because he was a Democrat, but he understood the subjugation of the black inner city by the Democratic Party better than anybody. He just understood it completely, and it disgusted him. And so he would give me a lot of advice on how not to pay attention to this person, not to pay attention to that person, to go forward with this case. And I mean, he was very, very valuable.
Now, as I'm watching all
this, I couldn't run against him.
Publicly, it was perceived that you were ready for that race, and you would have done it. I'm just saying this might have been fake news had you been able to appoint your successor, and I think you wanted Wilson, and they wanted somebody else.
Yeah, I was always reluctant about running for the Senate, even when I was going to think about running against Hillary. I wasn't sure I would belong in the Senate.
Okay.
And so I would go along with it, and I would think about ways to do it. And I've never known when push came to shove if I actually would have done it. But yeah, there was some attempt to see if I would do it. And that issue really came up when I ran for mayor. I had to get Benito Romano in as my successor. So that's what got me thinking about running for mayor. So they wanted me to run for the Senate, and I started thinking, maybe I should run for mayor. Why not just try? So if I lose, I go back to law practice. And then out of the blue, right after the 1988 election, when Bush was elected, Guy Molinari was on television on one of the Sunday talk shows, and he was asked, why do Republicans never have a candidate for mayor? And he said, well, I think we have one this time. I think Rudy Giuliani would be terrific. He had never called me. I hardly knew him. And my office is overwhelmed with calls. So I have to make an announcement. I'm not going to talk to anybody about it. I call up Guy. I said, I'm not going to meet you and talk to you about this until I resign. And please don't say anything else more about it, because I shouldn't be considering it now. My friend Denny Young, who was my chief assistant and the most ethical guy in the world, almost had a heart attack when this happened. And he cut off all communication with D'Amato and everybody else. We don't talk to anybody. And I spent 2 months wrapping up what I was going to do. I left in late January, and I immediately started running for mayor.
What do you attribute your success to? I mean, I guess your success was your success. I mean, look, you became an international star as U.S. attorney. I mean, no kidding. I'm not just, I mean, as a kid, you know, I was very much aware of you. You were on the front page of the New York Times Magazine, which that was a big deal. I mean, you were kind of Elliot Ness all over again. And there are plenty of U.S. attorneys out there. I guess it was what? The creative use of RICO. It was going after Wall Street.
It was. I was in a very fortunate position in a couple of ways. First of all, I had been my boss. So I knew the Justice Department really well, and I could get the resources I wanted. Kind of reminds me a little bit of Ukraine right now. So when I envisioned the commission case, I spent 3 months planning it and therefore trying to figure out what did I need to fill it in. I knew exactly what I needed. I needed FBI agents that could break into houses. So I got a meeting with Bill Smith and with...
When you say Bill Smith, William French Smith?
William French. Okay. He was my boss and friend. I worked for him for 3 years, and I was very close to him. I was with him every single day when I was Associate Attorney General at staff meetings and did many, many things with him. So I went to see him, and I asked if Bill Webster be there, and I briefed him on the case. I brought Mike Chertoff with me. He was my assistant on that case, and we showed him what we had. And I showed him my plan of how I would bring it up to date. And I said, to do that, I got to do a lot of wiretaps and bugs. Because that's the only thing we don't have the people. We don't have enough people that are going to turn on the mafia. And I said to Bill, I want some of your counterintelligence people. Because they know how to break into buildings. The criminal guys don't. We got to do this very, very surgically. And he gave me... He's transferred a group of people from counterintelligence. He used to go after communists, right? And I used to work with them in the Justice Department. I did 50 FISA warrants against Soviets, and I got the guys I wanted who knew how to break in. They've been doing it since the 40s. They knew every apartment building in the city. They knew how to wire it. As a result of that, in a 4 or 5 month period, we got into Castellano's office, his White House. We got into Matty the Horse's, Matty the Horse had an office in Midtown Manhattan where he adjudicated complaints about private carding so they wouldn't kill each other. So if you had a route in the Bronx and I had a route in Queens and we got into a fight, Matty would be the judge. And he would say, oh, you get this, you get that, you get this. No whacking. We actually videoed that office. We got in and we put cameras in. The best one was Fat Tony's Social Club in East Harlem. It took us 2 months to get in, but we got in that. We wired it up. So by the time we got to the end of the case, we had them on tape. I mean, we had 4,000 hours of them talking about, you know, running Las Vegas, running the Teamsters Union. People don't remember that we dislodged the Teamsters Union. We got rid of the entire management of the Teamsters Union, took it over.
I have to respect your time. I have two more questions, and then
We can do another one.
Exactly.
We can finish it up.
But can I ask you this? You were thinking very seriously about becoming a priest. You ultimately did not do it. Understandably so. I mean, mm-hmm. What role does your faith play now in your life?
Very big. Very, very big role. And sometimes I'm guilty about it because it plays a role when I need it. And I try have it play a role when I don't need it, because you always need it. But by that I mean, for example, September 11. The minute I saw a man jump from the top, that was kind of the traumatic moment, the moment that switched September 11 from an emergency to a once-in-a-lifetime emergency, was when I was down there walking toward the fire department command post. The two buildings were burning, and I was looking up. I couldn't believe this. I saw a man hesitating and then throwing himself down. And when he hit bottom, I grabbed, I think, Bernie Kerik's arm. I think it was Bernie. I said, Bernie, this is way beyond us. We've never handled anything like this. And we were pretty arrogant. We thought we could handle any emergency. We developed an emergency management center. We used to train. We had gotten West Nile virus right, and the CDC had gotten it wrong. I mean, we said it was West Nile virus for four or five days. They disputed it with us, and we were right, and they were wrong. So we were pretty darn arrogant at this point. But this thing just... Phew. And then I said to him, we're going to make decisions. We got to do the best we can do, logical decisions. And then each time we got to pray for God to make it right. And I'm very spiritual. I believe in God. I believe in an afterlife. I believe in, I don't understand it completely. I don't think anybody does. I have a tremendous background in theology and the history of religion. So I kind of enjoy that more intellectually. Like I could talk about theology just as much as I could talk about politics and enjoy it. But I pray a lot. And I really do believe that there's a plan. And it's our job to try to do the best we can here and make life better for people. And I have the same confusions that everybody has when you see horrible things happen and you ask, why does God let this happen? And I guess I've come to terms with that God has given us free will. And if we didn't have free will, we would just be little automatons. And let us choose where we want to go.
Mr. Mayor, it is a real privilege talking to you. But I have to do it again, all right, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and I
got to
tell you how much I enjoy your show.
Thank you, sir.
It's one of the very, very best.
Let me know what you think. I love to go down little rabbit holes and little sidebars, and I want to make sure I have it all straight in my head. And that's the thing about a podcast. You know, I can't, you know, it's even for me, I don't really talk to people like that for a long period of time. Two people talking for an hour? That's unusual, where you're not checking your phones. I've noticed that I like to listen to conversations like that. And now I like to engage in them, and I hope you do too. Let me know what you think. You can go to thegregkellypodcast.com, shoot me an email, and also, and this would be great, because Terrence K. Williams is an awesome American hero in his own right. He has this new company, Cousin T's. It's a great pancake, all right? A great pancake batter. You will love it. I love it. And I'm proud to be working with Cousin T and his pancake company. So go to CousinT's.com. Cousin T's. That's the word cousin. T-S. .com. CousinTs.com. CousinTs.com for the best pancakes this country has ever tasted. And if you enter in GK25, my initials, and then 25, you will get 25% off. CousinTs.com. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the podcast. To be continued on WABC Radio, Newsmax TV, and always on Twitter, @GregKellyUSA. Many, many thanks. All the best.